Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. I'd like to welcome you. You can watch today's program by going to PRN.fm and our Facebook page. We're going to deal with the latest on health and nutrition. Then I have a commentary about what has happened to our freedom of speech. I'm going to give a larger commentary with share insights from John Whitehead, who has a program on PRN, but also I'm going to read you an article that I knew would be coming, and it was in yesterday's paper about, are they joking? Columbia University Comics mic is cut. Whoa. Plus, for those of you who are on the point of trying to figure out what all these different gender identities are and at what point does a person realize the consequences of making a decision that they cannot reverse. Tucker Carlson had a person on, and she speaks for a lot within the liberal community. I thought you could just listen to what they had to say and then call in and share your points of view. During the past week, we have had nonstop coverage in the American media about President Bush Sr. He is called noble, polite, diplomatic, a gentleman, an important president in our history. Both the conservative and liberal media, even Democracy Now!, have had people who, even if they want to be critical, stop short. We won't stop short. Barbara Honecker, who knew him personally, will be on and give us that insight. So we have a lot to share. Also, there was a school teacher who got up before the CDC and made a statement about the flu vaccine. I believe it's important that you can hear her. And we're going to have that clip. We always begin with the latest on health and healing. And this comes from Oregon State University, and it's about hazelnuts. Now, you hear of a lot of nuts. You rarely hear about Brazil nuts, filberts, pine nuts, and hazelnuts. Yet they're also important. And according to this, hazelnuts improve your micronutrient levels in your brain and your body. If you're over the age of 40, you're considered older. Older adults who added hazelnuts to their diet for just a few months significantly improved their levels of two key micronutrients. And that's significant because the more micronutrients you have circulating, the better it is for you. And that's about one-third of a cup, which is a very small amount, daily for 4 months. And their vitamin E and the alpha tocopherol was increased substantially. Also, celery seed extract, something almost no one takes in the United States, can lower high blood pressure. This was a human study, University of Chicago Medical Center, just out today. Now, celery seed extract contains an important compound known as 3NB. And this 3NB, it's responsible for the characteristic flavor and odor of celery. It was discovered as the active component in celery that would help lower blood pressure and also help relieve arthritis. So two very important things we could benefit from. Now, I suggest you start your day. First, when you get up, always take a tongue cleaner, use some mouthwash, hopefully with a small amount of hydrogen peroxide, killing all the bacteria. Also, it'll get rid of the oils that are in the tongue, and that's where your bad breath frequently comes from. And you gently take the tongue cleaner from the back to the front, wash it, do it twice, because if you eat or drink anything upon arising, all of that bad bacteria on the tongue and in the mouth, around the gums and the teeth, all that you're swallowing. You don't want that in your system, and that'll clean up your breath and give you fresh breath. Then I suggest you take celery, cucumber, and green apple. Make a 16-ounce glass, which is not a lot, but in that 16 ounces, 2 ounces should be ginger juice and 2 ounces should be lemon juice and 1 teaspoon of apple cider vinegar. Now, you drink that down, it's going to help your blood pressure. It's going to kill parasites. It's going to alkalize the blood. It's going to help you if you have pain. It's really terrific on all levels. So that's important. Or you can eat celery, and that also can help, and it'll drop your blood pressure. In fact, a lot of people had it drop really substantially. And then we have this lounging around all weekend may weigh heavily on the minds of the health conscious. But these sedentary stretches may not affect the waistline, provided they're preceded by some exercise. So, according to University of Texas, Southwestern Medical Center, it shows neurons that influence metabolism are active for up to about 2 days after a single workout. So here's the takeaway message. If you know that you're going to go on an airplane or a car ride, or if you want to watch ball games on Sunday afternoon, which is great, then go for about a 45-minute workout prior to that. Then being sedentary for the afternoon won't harm you and won't cause increased weight. Also, being in nature makes your heart healthier. This is in the University of Louisville, and this is a brand new study that finds that people who live in leafier areas have lower levels of several stress-related biomarkers, including adrenaline. Now, this was important because just going for a walk in a park, if you don't have a park near you, of course, in a public park, can make a difference and keep you de-stressed. Being able to sit by water. And if you don't have any water to sit by, then get a CD of waterfalls or ocean or a rainstorm, and it actually does the same thing. And it also helps you lose weight and de-stresses you, improves metabolism, and improves blood sugar and blood pressure. From Washington State University, apples assist weight loss. Now, we know that apples are good. They're loaded with quercetin along with onions, which is really good for repairing damage to your skin. And if you have any bruising, if you have cuts and scratches, and if you have saggy skin, to have tighter skin on your face and neck, quercetin, Q-U-E-R-E-C-T-I-N, quercetin, along with vitamin C in equal amounts, 2,000 milligrams quercetin, 2,000 milligrams vitamin C, and it helps recombine collagen, the connective tissue that the skin, in effect, hangs on. So it strengthens it, makes your skin firmer. Well, apples also have been beneficial in a lot of different ways because they're rich in antioxidants, and they help regulate your blood sugar. This is published in Food Chemistry. Why? Because apples contain fiber and phenolic, P-H-E-N-O-L-I-C, compounds which have been shown to help protect against many diseases. Now, there are two types of fiber. There's soluble fiber and insoluble fiber. You want the non-digestible fiber content of apples, and as a result, it cleans up the intestine, provides a great medium for good bacteria to thrive and feed on the non-digested fiber to produce short-chain fatty acids, which are the result of fermentation in the gut. So short-term fats may help to sustain energy, stabilize your blood sugar, improve satiety, and keep you full. And also, the U.S. Geological Survey has just shown us this week that our nation's water supply is disrupting the human endocrine system. Why? or how. Exposure to emerging contaminants, even at extremely low doses, parts per billion, can cause adverse health effects for all of us, but especially when it comes to endocrine disruption, which can lead to developmental malformations and interference with reproduction and increased cancer risk and disturbances in the immune and nervous system functions. And these emerging contaminants include the pharmaceuticals, personal care products, hormones, perfumes. They all end up in the water, and we don't want that. Hence, only drink filtered, or if you're out, and you know that the water is pure from well water and it's been tested, and test your water. You can take it to a public water department. They generally don't charge anything. And make sure your water is clean. Also, there's a link now between newborn babies' vitamin D deficiency and schizophrenia. This is Aarhus University in Denmark. So if you are taking vitamin D as the parent, the mother, you're more likely to have the placenta have adequate vitamin D. But if you're not taking vitamin D, you're probably going to be deficient, which means then that you're increasing the risk of the newborn being deficient in vitamin D, and that increases the risk of schizophrenia later in life for that newborn. That was also research done at the University of Queensland. So that can prevent a lot of people from having mental conditions later in life. All you have to do is make sure you're getting enough vitamin D3 each day. And also from Trinity College, which is in Dublin, a brand new study shows that vitamin D deficiency creates greater risk of depression. So this was the Irish long-term study on aging at Trinity College, and it showed for the first time in Ireland that a deficiency in vitamin D was associated with substantial increase in risk of depression the older you got. And they did a four-year follow-up and found that that was actually the case. This was posted in the Journal of Post-Acute and Long-Term Medical Care. We always try to bring you the latest on health and healing. And, oh, by the way, drawing is better than writing for memory retention. This University of Waterloo, which is up in Canada. So as you age, if you begin to draw, that can enhance your memory. That's good news. So a lot of people, even a friend of mine, just recently drew a pumpkin and sent it to me and said, hey, I never knew I had any art skills or could draw, and look at this. And it was a very good rendition of a pumpkin, a good place to start on that journey. Releasing the artist in you can make a difference. And also, University of Utah showed that the more air pollution, the greater risk of miscarriage. So the air quality has been associated with numerous adverse health outcomes, from asthma to preterm birth. Now it's showing a greater risk of miscarriage, up to 16% miscarriage if you live in a very polluted environment. One more reason to select the places in this world to live that are going to honor your health. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest in health and nutrition. We're going to take a break and come right back. And when we come back, we're going to come right back into a segment where Tucker Carlson at Fox, on some things I would agree with him, some I don't. And there's one thing that both he and Sean Hannity do that's unnerving. Maybe they just don't have anyone close enough to stand up and say, fellas, you're very, very disruptive to your guest. If you have someone on, let them say what they have to say. Then challenge them. Then keep quiet. They're like Bill O'Reilly. It's very hard for me. And I listen, I scan to see how everyone's covering an issue, if they're balanced or not balanced, objective or not. And Hannity's the most unnerving because he goes through a whole monologue, then asks a question, then interrupts his guest and gives an explanation. He just can't stop wanting to hear himself talk. And he keeps repeating himself ad nauseum. Anyhow, that's my opinion. But you're going to hear Tucker Carlson talking with a woman. And wow, this is also that woman who was suggesting, along with another woman who started it, that you should not change a baby's diaper unless the baby shows you approval. This is how far we've come from reason and responsible thinking in our society. Oh, by the way, I was asked yesterday that now that it's winter and a person's inside all day, this was an older, I guess, around 90-year-old gentleman, and he's a retired professor, and he said, I'm inside all the time. I know it's not good, but it's so cold here. I said, well, why are you living here? You're retired, you're on a pension, you have Social Security, you probably have good savings. Move to a warmer climate. How about that? He said, well, are there any house plants that I could use to help clean up my air? Yes, there are house plants to purify the air indoors. And Garden Mum, that's M-U-N, is one of the best air purifying plants. And this plant can get rid of your home benzene, formaldehyde, ammonia, and xylene. And Garden Mum is common and inexpensive and can be bought at garden stores. You can also plant it outside once the winter season ends. Peace Lily, L-I-L-Y. And it's a very nice-looking plant as well. And it can eliminate formaldehyde and ammonia and trichloroethylene from the air. And it has a very high transpiration rate, which means it can both purify and humidify indoor air. And it's easy to take care of because it tolerates neglect. And most people, unfortunately, neglect their plants. And then you have the rubber plant. And that was one of the first plants I bought when I was in New York, in this tiny little apartment. And it's one of the single best plants for removing formaldehyde. It also is easy to take care of because it can survive with very little light and can tolerate cooler temperatures as low as 40 degrees Fahrenheit for short periods. And however, don't ever put the rubber plant in direct sunlight, especially in the summer. And then you have the spider plant. So if you're looking for a house plant that will clean and purify the air and is easy to take care of and grow, spider plants are what you need. So just a few things I thought would help you out there. I'm Gary Knoll. That's the latest on health and healing. Back in a moment, we're going to go right into a segment, a short segment, where what they're doing, they're talking about the whole you must honor the child's choice of what they want to become. Do you believe that? Do you believe that at the age of 4, your child is mature enough, intelligent enough, aware enough of all the consequences of becoming a boy or a girl, or one of the dozens and dozens of transgender identifications they have? You decide. And then I'm going to have a short window for you to call in and share your points of view. Our talkback number is 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. Back in a moment.
This mean if you're going to raise a baby, how would you be able to change your child's diaper? Because the second you change the diaper, of course, you'd no longer be able to pretend that there was a question about whether this was a boy or a girl. You would know.
Well, it's not about pretending. The parent definitely knows the gender. It's about not necessarily labeling the baby. It's about allowing the baby to decide what gender that baby wants to be when that baby can decide, which is around 4 years old. So from 0 to 4, the baby will not be labeled. The labeling theory will not apply. apply from 0 to 4 years old. The baby will be a they-be, neither a boy nor a girl, whatever gender that baby
now, what other
chooses to be.
What other profound life decisions do we think people ought to be making at the age of four? Are there any others?
Well,
you know, whether to get a tattoo, whether to get married, enlisting in the military, voting, drinking vodka, smoking Marlboro Reds. Is there anything else that we think four-year-olds are ready to decide?
This isn't actually a profound life decision. I mean, biologically, there's nothing really going on from 0 to 4 in that area that affects a person's life. Biologically, the experts say that boys and girls, all genders are alike. The boy's brain, the male brain might be a little larger. The female's language might be a little bit more advanced.
Okay. No
maybe,
sexism on my show. Hold on. Whoa,
sorry,
slow down. No,
sorry.
Here you're out there like
they say maybe
boys' brains
are
larger. And yeah. I just want to say that kind of toxic masculinity has no place in this program.
Sorry.
Thank you very much.
But that's all
but
they can
no, look,
think of.
The bottom line is all they can think of, like difference in brain size, difference in genitalia,
perhaps,
difference in bone structure.
Perhaps.
Just minor things like
minor.
Just minor things like that.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
Not perhaps, like factually. So those are not minor things. Those are definitive things.
Minor.
So, like, why would you not tell your kids about that? You know, at some point they're going to drop trial and look down and say, wait, we look different. And you're going to be like, no, you don't. You're exactly the same.
And
that's lying, isn't
that's
it?
That's when the child, they say, is around 4 years old. So around 0 to 4, we're not going to say to a little female, a girl, that you're a little princess, or boy, you're such a tiger. The labels are gone. You're not going to put that outside influence on a child. You're just going to be neutral. Everything's going to be neutral.
The outside influence of biological reality.
Not
so would
reality,
you do this with anything
perception.
Else? Would you, could no, but could we?
Okay, let's get this clear. She is suggesting there's a large movement behind her that when your baby is born, it cannot be identified as a boy or girl, even if it's born as a boy or a girl. They want that baby to make up its own mind what it wants to be at four, that it's fully capable of making that decision at four. That's the new political correctness. That's identity politics at the extreme. What do you think? I'd like to hear what you had to say. And to get you an opportunity now that you've heard their argument, and by the way, she's highly respected in the liberal community, give us a call at 888-874-4888. All right? And do you have any idea where this is going when they had that much control over parents? And I want to hear what you have to say. I'm going to hold my own thoughts. Now let's hear from this hospital nurse about the flu shot. And this is before a CDC panel.
Keep under the 3 minutes so that we can listen to everyone. I'm a little shorter than she is. I'll try to talk fast. I don't come here with any degree. I come here as the public. I live locally. You are one and all. I'm going to start with a quote by William Wilberforce. And he stated, you can choose to look away, but you can never say you don't know again. I just retired from a local hospital here. No one believes in the flu shots. My colleagues, I didn't. Because the efficacy, and I won't give you data, you created the data, 10% 1 year, 18% the next, 40% at best. The flu mist you gave to our children from 2 to 8 years, for almost 4 years, it never worked, 3%. Oh, well, you know, I worked in a hospital where my colleagues, doctors and nurses and medical assistants and patient care and lab, we didn't believe in the flu shot. We were probably at 40%, and then came your mandates. And then came your recommendations. So you know what? For 4 years before I retired, I put a mask on, 12-hour shifts. It wasn't easy to breathe, but that's how much I didn't believe in your efficacy. My colleagues didn't believe in it either, but some of them couldn't wear that mask for 12 hours. So in the beginning, they said, I'm just getting the shot. I can't wear the mask. But in the truth, the public's truth, my observation, which is the first step in scientific theory, they didn't believe in your shot. This year, I retired. I'm grateful for that because my soul was sick at what I saw go on. That flu shot was crazy. At first it was 10%. How can you do data? Which 10 got the shot out of 100? Then it was 30. And then you get up here today and make new implications on our children and combine four. Really? You govern globally and this country. I'm glad I'm retired now because now I can talk to you. Because you know what? While I worked, I couldn't. Because if I did, conflict of interest, I would have lost my job. That's truth. A lot of my colleagues did lose their jobs. I was one of the few hospitals in this city that allowed us to mask. I can name five hospitals that don't. Goodbye, pink slip, no flu shot. How did I survive 20 years and never get the flu in that environment? ER, high volume. Was I not on the front lines? Every flu case, 300 people a day. Every flu case, it was me. I never had the flu. You know why? I knew how to wash my hands. I knew how to take vitamin D. I knew how to take elderberry syrup. I don't approve of your flu shot. Now you have pharmacists giving it. You bribe us with cards at Target, and you tell us this is free, and it's everywhere, and get it, get it, get it. They're scare tactics, and you should be ashamed. And then I will end because I do want my colleagues, the other moms that know what the CDC doesn't do for us. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., he fights for us. He does. He goes and goes to court for us, for our kids that suffered. I'm looking around. Some of you are my age. And if I'm mistaken, I apologize. But I'm in a generation where I got 7 shots. 26 years later, my daughter got 10. Her son got probably 60. My new grandson's expected to get 72, and I just watched you add more. I'm appalled. Robert Kennedy Jr., you know what he says?
Good for you. There should be millions more speaking up. And who are the people not speaking up? Medical doctors. Shame on them for being the cowards they are. Because if the medical doctors who have the insight and intelligence and wherewithal to read the actual scientific literature, as I have over 15,000 hours, and the other people like Dr. Tony Bark and Dr. Nancy Banks, we've all spent thousands of hours studying the literature, and we can find no truth in any of your statements about vaccines. You are pathological liars. And sooner or later, enough Americans will wake up to this, but unfortunately, they only wake up after their kid ends up dead or with autism or some other brain condition, or they do. We have one person that's called in thus far who wants to share their point of view on this whole idea of gender. Your turn. What's your name, please?
My name's John.
John, where are you calling from?
Denver, Colorado.
Okay. John, please share your thoughts with us.
You know, this whole gender thing, it's just so stupid. It just insults my intelligence to even hear people talk about something as silly as this. Everybody knows the difference between a male and a female. And I can't believe people waste air time talking about something as ridiculous as this.
But they do, and they believe in this. Now, these same people who spend all their waking time fighting to classify dozens of genders, I'm asking them, when was the last time you gave up meat because you cared enough about the saving the planet from the sixth mass extinction that is occurring now? Or when you fought to have universal health care so no one had to go bankrupt or die because they were neglected or denied proper medical care, or they fought against Citizen United so that we didn't have politics controlled by special interests and oligarchs and money and get it out of there. And I find none of that happening. So none of the important issues that actually impact our lives are being addressed. But this is their right to do it, and unfortunately they have captured an entire segment of the community and are using that as their one of their important talking points instead of the ones that we should be paying attention to. But the more important issue is, can a four-year-old make such a radical decision and then live with the consequences? Because they don't know how many people I've counseled who decided that the thought that they had to be the other sex and then made that choice surgically and then realized it wasn't the right choice and when to come back. They have no idea how many of those people commit suicide, how many of them are under psychiatric care, how many of them are living with high-level depression because it was the wrong choice for them. We don't talk about that, and we don't hear their stories, and the media excludes them from the discussion as if it's already a fait accompli, and it shouldn't be. You want to open up for all points of view? Fine. That's what we should be doing, having open, honest, intelligent forms where people have an opportunity to share a point of view and we can agree or disagree. But because one small group has an opinion because it impacts them and their lives does not mean that they should have the right to coerce or demand and even get laws passed that impacts all of us. That's Norwegian. Thank you for your call. I appreciate it. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. In about 5 minutes, we're going to Barbara Honecker to talk about George Bush and the real legacy, the one that virtually all the media seems to have denied and tried to rewrite history. Well, we're not about rewriting history here. We're about reporting honest history. And we will with her in a few minutes. But a couple new things, some exciting news right now. I'm happy to announce for the first time the availability, at least online, as an ebook. The hardback will be is being printed now, another 6 weeks, I believe. But as of today, you can download two of my brand new books. One is called Curing the Incurable, and I've been working on this a long time. And you can actually see some photographs of the. I'll show you a couple. Maybe four or five photographs from some of the recipes. And the first whole, this is a big book too. It's over 700 pages, I believe. I'm not sure the exact count, but it's a big book. But we have everything in here, the foods that alkalize the body, the nutrients that are important, the best, the most nutrient-dense foods you can bring, the best juices to bring. But the whole first section of the book are all the physicians I interviewed around the United States who were able to cure their patients who were considered incurable. And these are board-certified physicians, the vast majority you've never heard of. Cancer, heart disease, depression, anxiety, they're all in there. And the person that redid Rife's microscope and is able now to help people by synchronizing pulses into the body by light pulses, and helping him. I've actually watched that, and I followed up, and it works. Dr. Dean Ornish, who was the first major physician to talk about how to reverse heart disease with diet and lifestyle over 40 years ago, he's in here, and he just reversed 9 people's need for heart transplant, where they'd have to remove a damaged heart and replace with another heart. None of those people had to have their heart transplanted. They got back to health, and we filmed them. So you have their stories, and all that's in the first chapter. Then wonderful recipes, and we're going to put up some of the recipes on the screen so you can see them. These are just some of the different dishes that you're going to be looking at, and these are gourmet, vegan, gluten-free recipes, and lots of them. I believe about 170, plus all kinds of interesting insights and information. The book is packed with information, and it's there's another one of the rice salads, and I'm just looking now at the monitor, and so anyhow, you have a lot of different dishes that you can use, and the most tasty dessert, soup, salads, entrees, side dishes, sauces, it's all here. So this is the Curing the Incurable Cookbook, right now only available online. And at about, I'm believing it's a big savings here, you get 30% off. It's $24.99. And if you just go to prn.fm or garynall.com, you can order it. All right? And we'll get you the cookbook. You can just download it right there and then for yourself. So that's the first book. The next book I'll mention next week. I just finished reading this paper, and it says, "Are they joking? Non-politically correct Columbia University comics microphone cut." And it goes on to talk about how a former Saturday Night Live writer who was just performing was yanked off the stage and condemned because some students didn't like his humor. Remember I said last week that today Don Rinkles and Richard Pryor, Lenny Bruce, Shelley Berman, Sophie Tucker, Mort Saul, George Carlin, some of the greats would never be allowed to speak in many college campuses. That's unfortunate. But then again, think of how many college campuses don't allow even the professors or instructors to teach the way we appreciated being spoken with and taught growing up. Oh, no, if you're going to say something that someone, one student, may find offensive, you have to give warnings, and you have to prepare them for that word, an innocuous word. That's how far down the rabbit hole we've gone. What you're going to see now is a gentleman, Brett Weinstein, testifying under oath before Congress about Evergreen State College. This is a state college. And what's going on about freedom of speech and the new teaching models being used. I thought you'd find this of interest. Let's watch.
Mr. Chairman, distinguished members of the committee, thank you for the invitation to address you. Tomorrow is the one-year anniversary of the day 50 Evergreen students that I had never met, disrupted my class, accusing me of racism and demanding my resignation. I tried to reason with them. I felt no fear because I knew that whatever my failings might be, bigotry was not among them. At that moment, I felt sure I could reach them. I also felt a moral obligation to try. That racism squanders human potential and erodes human dignity offends me. I am also well versed in the evolutionary logic that makes racism durable. I should have had no trouble establishing common ground. Their response surprised me. It would take months for me to fully understand what had happened. The protesters had no apparent interest in the very dialogue they seemed to invite. I was even more surprised by the protesters' fervor in shouting down my actual students, some of whom had known me for years. The cruelty and derision reserved for students of color who spoke in my defense was particularly troubling. If not discussion, what did they want? I was one of Evergreen's most popular professors. I had Evergreen's version of tenure. Did they really think they could force my resignation based on a meritless accusation? They did think that, and they were right. What I had not counted on was their alliance with Evergreen's new president. Though the protesters openly humiliated him, the president of the college partnered with the mob in private, handing them concession after concession. We know this because the rioters filmed everything and proudly uploaded it. In one particularly telling video, the president calmly discusses with the leaders of the protest a demand to target STEM faculty based on the empty assertion that scientists are particularly prone to bias. In that same video, the president speaks of his plan for those who resist the new order. Bring them in, train them, and if it doesn't take, sanction them. He invites his partners to hold him to it. On the second day of unrest, the police chief called me. Rioters were stopping traffic and searching for someone car to car. The chief believed they were searching for me. She was worried for my safety and helpless to protect me, as the president had ordered her force to stand down. What would have transpired if the rioters had found me? I still don't know, and I strongly suspect they don't either. The protest at my class did not emerge out of the blue in May of 2017. 1 year earlier, I stood up and spoke in opposition to a dangerous proposal, one that threatened to establish a racial hierarchy amongst faculty. To those who have not faced something similar, this likely sounds hyperbolic. But one can now advance such policies and almost certainly succeed in passing them if they are properly draped in weaponized terminology. Equity, for example, has taken on special properties. If a person opposes an equity proposal, those advancing the proposal are secure in asserting that the person is motivated by opposition to racial equity itself. In other words, they are racist. My opposition to that first equity proposal was voiced to my colleagues with no students present. Demands for my resignation 1 year later, in May of 2017, were not the result of organic student confusion. They were payback for violating a de facto code of faculty conduct in which one's right to speak is now dictated by adherence to an ascendant orthodoxy in which one's race, gender, and sexual orientation are paramount. The students were on a mission. They were unwitting tools of a witting movement. This committee should take my tale as cautionary. Is there a free speech crisis on college campuses? One can certainly make that argument, but that portrayal is at least as misleading as it is informative. What is occurring on college campuses is about power and control. Speech is impeded as a last resort, used when people or groups fail to self-censor in response to a threat of crippling stigma and the destruction of their capacity to earn. These tools are being used to unhook the values that bind us together as a nation: equal protection under the law, the presumption of innocence, a free marketplace of ideas, the concept that people should be judged by the content of their character rather than the color of their skin. Yes, even that core tenet of the civil rights movement is being dismantled. Am I alleging a conspiracy? No. What I have seen functions much more like a cult, in which the purpose is only understood by the leaders, and the rest have been seduced into a carefully architected fiction. Most of the people involved in this movement earnestly believe that they are acting nobly to end oppression. Only the leaders understand that the true goal is to turn the tables of oppression. Something is seriously and dangerously amiss. At this moment in history, the center does not hold. Partisan polarization and political corruption have rendered government ineffective, predatory, and often cruelly indifferent to the suffering of American citizens. Tribalism is the natural result. Evergreen's public meltdown placed me in the eye of the storm and cast me into the spotlight. As a member of the intellectual dark web, I find myself at the vanguard of an emerging, non-ideological, non-partisan movement. Along with the Heterodox Academy and the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, we are fighting to restore civility and respect for competing perspectives. The electorate is starved for honest debate and for the good governance that follows from it. My advice to this body is to put the nation and its core values ahead of partisanship and join us in the center to end this cultish power grab and return us to a forward path as a nation. I look forward to your questions.
What has been the reaction to what happened to you, both on campus and off campus? Have any changes been made?
The campus has doubled down on every foolish idea it was pursuing and has gotten itself into very serious financial trouble for lack of students, which I should tell you, I warned my colleagues that if they pursued this false equity proposal, that would be the result. So a rather predictable disaster is occurring on campus. I do want to push back a little bit, though, on the assessment that it is the left, because really it isn't one left. There is an ascendant orthodoxy on the left that is very troubling. It is quite broad, but I think not very deep. Then there's a concentrated mirror image of that on the far right, and both of these things are to be feared. The problem, though, is when you speak out on a college campus from a perspective on the left that does not fit this orthodoxy, you are immediately categorized as on the right, which makes it look that the left is monolithic and all shares this opinion, but it's not the case.
Dr. Weinstein, what happened in your classroom, which I've seen videos of, was your classroom that day a safe space or a free speech zone or neither?
Thank you for asking me that question. A safe space
didn't look like it was safe to me.
Well, I believe in something that could be called a safe space. But what safe space means to me as an educator is a space safe enough to take risks, which is roughly the opposite meaning of what is being invoked on college campuses. The answer to your question is that a free speech zone cannot coexist with a safe space, because a safe space, by definition, according to this orthodoxy, is a place where you are free from being offended. So it cannot, it is mutually exclusive. But if you would allow me to, I feel that there's
in a safe space, could you say this sentence? Could you say, Donald Trump is president of the United States? Could you say that in a safe space on college campuses today?
Well, it depends which version of safe space you mean. If you mean a safe space the way it is used in common parlance on college campuses today, then the question of whether or not you can say it is contingent on whether or not somebody will be offended by that observation.
Now think about that. You can't even state a fact, provable, right? I saw his tweet this morning. It's provable. He's the president, right?
Mr. Chairman.
You cannot do that. This shows the absurdity of what is going on campuses, and you have lived it in a physical way. Dr. Stanger has lived it in a physical way. This is what is scary. Dr. Stanger is raising her head. Mr. Weinstein, you have the floor, so you'd have to yield time to her. But
you don't have to.
Okay. I think this is important enough to warrant a minute or two. We are continuing in this hearing to run up against the bluntness of the tool that we have at our disposal for discussing the issue at hand. So there is an importance to what takes place on a college campus. Free expression is a key feature of what takes place on college campuses that makes civilization function. But the application of the First Amendment to that free expression is almost arbitrary. Does it matter more that something takes place at Evergreen, which happens to be public, than if it takes place at Harvard, which happens to be private? Do those distinctions even make any sense when fully 80% of the funding that drives Evergreen is private tuition money, and I don't know what fraction, but a very large fraction of what drives Harvard is NIH and NSF money? So these distinctions are arbitrary, and what we should be protecting is the ability to exchange ideas in a way that actually allows education. It is also true that when people self-censor because they're afraid of stigma, they may never get around to the place where somebody blocks their speech, and so there may be no technical violation, but nonetheless, the effect is exactly the same. There is also a problem in the sense that the conflict is really between members of the audience. One section of the audience is deciding what other members of the audience can listen to. Yep. The person's speech who is inhibited is almost beside the point. It's a question of whether you can choose what you want to entertain as a concept. And then when this jumps the fence and leaves the college campuses and moves into the outer world, we're going to run into an even bigger problem where the tech sector is now the de facto governance apparatus for the new public square, and it's private, so the First Amendment doesn't apply.
Take the example of Harvard, which you talked about, Dr. Weinstein, whether it's DOD funds, whether it's NIH funds, or whether it's Pell Grant funding. There are so many federal dollars that underpin the way Harvard functions and their budget on an annual basis. And the fact that the university can penalize students because they join an outside organization, zero affiliation with Harvard, they're not allowed to be sports captains, they're not allowed to be considered for fellowships, and I think that is a significant overstep of the university's role. I wanted to give other panelists an opportunity to respond. Dr. Weinstein.
Well, the first thing to say is I'm not a legal expert, but I would certainly support the idea that leverage generated by the funding that is given by the federal government would morally be justified to use that to make sure that college campuses protect the free expression. But I would also point out that this is not just a matter of abstract ideas presented by speakers on campus. This is now extending into the classroom, and it's a question of what one can properly teach in a biology class, for example, which may well not be politically correct, but is nonetheless necessary for students to understand.
I'd be interested in you sharing your thoughts on that, and if not for today's show, then share them over the internet by going to prnstudio@gmail.com, prnstudio@gmail.com. And I'd like to talk about them on tomorrow's show, about what's happened to teaching, the type of students that are going into our institutions, the type of institutions that are allowing the helicopter parents and their kids to dictate how something's taught, what they're going to go to class for, and what they're not going to go to class for. I'd like your opinion. Please share it. Now we're going to finish our program today with an insight in what makes a perfect relationship.
Buy this car, you'll get girls. Buy this bra, you'll get guys. And we're seeing it so much that we start believing these lies, but the truth is, the makeup they're selling to make you feel prettier is the same makeup you buy to stop. They keep telling you that you are not enough. And what about the movies we watch, all the shows on TV? The more I watch, the more I see. I need you to complete me. And yes, love is the answer, love is the key, but if you can't love yourself, how could you ever love me? And loving yourself, what does that even mean? Like massages and selfies and that sort of thing? Because the more I think about it, the more it feels weird. I've always been taught that self-love was something to be feared. I've been taught that arrogance is bad and vanity, it's not good. And even my bracelets are telling me to act how Jesus would. So what should I do? How should I act? I'm supposed to love myself, but how do I even do that? Well, I got a trick that I picked up from a friend who noticed that I was quick to defend her when she would say something negative about herself. She would say, I'm so dumb, and I'd say, you're so brilliant. She'd say, I'm so weak, and I'd say, you're so resilient. And when she said, I feel ugly, and I said, you look beautiful, she asked me why I was so dutifully filling up her cup constantly and yet treating my own cup so irresponsibly. Because when I looked in the mirror, my voice was quite clear. You're ugly, you're too thin, your hairline's receding, you got a pimple on your chin. And that was when she gave me a piece of advice that changed my life. She gave me a hug. And she said, treat yourself like someone you loved. Treat yourself like someone you loved. Now, I had been standing, but I needed to be sitting because I couldn't believe that I had been letting myself keep forgetting that I was who I'd been looking for. And deep in my core, I knew it was time to stop looking for more until I could look through all my fear and look into a mirror and see clearly that the man looking back at me was the only one who can make me happy, and I am already enough. And I am not any more special or unique than you. That is why I'm here to speak to you. You are already enough. And when you start to see that, you will start to be that. Your world will get brighter, your load will get lighter, and you can see that with life, you can be a lover, not a fighter. And that life, you deserve it. Because you are worth it. And there is no point in letting yourself keep forgetting, because no matter what you say or do, you are perfect. And so today, I hope I leave you with a direction correction away from the flaws you see in your reflection. They aren't flaws to me, they are simply protection against all the doubts you have of your perfection. So start today. Take a good, long look in the mirror and say, I am who I've been looking for.
That's our program for today. Thank you all for listening and watching. And don't forget the Progressive Commentary Hour every Tuesday evening at 7 p.m. Go to prn.fm to listen live to that. Have a nice day, everyone.
If you want something to play with, go and find yourself a toy. Baby, my time is too expensive, and I'm not a little boy. If you are serious, don't play with my heart. It makes me furious. But if you want me to love you, then a baby I will. Girl, you know I will. Tell it like it is. Don't be ashamed. Let your conscience be your guide. But I know deep down inside of me, I believe you love me. Forget your foolish pride. too short to have sorrow.